What would you do if you were hanging out by the creek looking for some cool trash to bring home? You're like, Jason, I don't collect trash. Well, what would happen if you did collect the trash when you suddenly stumbled across the bizarre life form who may be one of the most evil creatures to ever walk the earth? And then we travel to the high seas to take a look at a pirate ship that plundered its way across the ocean. But when sightings of this ship stopped, people wondered what happened to the ship and its crew. Little did they know they were not prepared for the diabolical answer. Today on Dead Rabbit Radio. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Dead Rabbit Radio. I'm your host, Jason Carpenter. I'm having a great day. Hope you guys are having a great day too. I hope you guys are having tons of fun doing whatever you're doing. We got a ton of stuff to cover today. So first off, running into Dead Rabbit Radio Command, everyone get on your feet and give it up for Tori. Woohoo, yeah, Tori's running on into Dead Rabbit Radio. Huge smile on her face. Tori, you're going to be our captain or pilot this episode. Tori is the better half of Tori and Tony. They've come out to see me at the Oregon Ghost Conference twice now. Really, really appreciate it. I love meeting you guys in person. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love it when I get your guys' emails and YouTube comments and that as well. But meeting you guys in person is just really, really cool. I really appreciate that. And so because of that, Tori, you're going to be our captain, our pilot this episode. If you guys can't support the show financially, if you guys can't see me speak live, totally understandable. Really, really is. Just help spread the word about Dead Rabbit Radio. That helps out so, so much. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell everyone you know. Dead Rabbit Radio is your favorite paranormal show. Tori, let's go ahead and get this party started. I'm going to toss you the keys to the Jason Jet. Everyone climb on board as Tori does a little flight check on this bad boy. We're leaving behind Dead Rabbit Radio Command to fly us all the way out. Oh, this is interesting. Fly us all the way out to Oregon. Probably should have taken the Jason Jalopy because this story takes place in my state. I forgot where it took place. We're headed out to a unnamed small town in Oregon. For all I know, it's Hood River. Like, this is a crazy story. We'll start kicking it around. First off, I want to give a shout out to Sustained Disgust. I found this on Sustained Disgust's iceberg that he made. Totally awesome. It's in the show notes. Check it out. It's one of the best icebergs out there because he provides the links. There's no more puzzling over what this means. Is this real? Is this word soup? Click a link. You got the article. It's really, really dope. I'll put it in the show notes. Thank you, Sustained Disgust. It's summer 1999. Light Funky Ones are rocketing to the top of the charts with their song Girl on TV. While Britney Spears is not toxic yet, she's still hitting babies one more time. 1999. We're about to meet this young woman. Her name is Paula. Her name is Paula M. She only gave her last initial. She has kind of a weird hobby. And she's driving her car around. She's looking for something very, very particular. She loves junkyards. But very, very specific junkyards. Like, she drives past a bunch of old rusted out cars. And there's like a big magnet picking up cars and dropping them in the crusher. All that stuff's going on. She's like, nope, that's not what I'm looking for. And then she goes to one. It's like a dumpster outside of McDonald's. It's just overflowing with rotten cheeseburgers and moldy bread. And the rats are all eating it and getting super strong from all those growth hormones. And she's like, nope, that's not what I'm looking for. She likes junk. And she likes junkyards and dump sites. So even like the places where people throw their beds out of the car because they didn't have anywhere else to put them. Because she's looking for vintage bottles. She's one of those. She's one of those people. She was Etsy before Etsy. She likes to find these vintage bottles, all like with the fancy labeling stuff on it, or no labels, but it's like bumpy. You know those beer bottles you can get that like are bumpy, right? Like the image is embossed in the glass itself, that kind of thing. She likes bumpy glass. You're like, Jason, I don't know what you mean, bumpy glass. You know what I mean. Haven't you ever had like an old-timey beer and like the bottle's bumpy? The label, it has a paper label because it has to have all these requirements that the government makes you put on there. Like, this drink doesn't contain lead. But then I was like, embossed? Is that the right word? Embossed glass? Anyways, she's looking for bumpy bottles and old glass. Her hands are all bandaged up. She's like, yesterday was a very successful trip. I slashed my hands up multiple times, but I got this great glass. She's headed out to this dump site to find some vintage bottles. Well, Paula, I guess, is part of some junkyard network because people in town start talking. Hey, Paula, I know you really like digging through the refuse. I know you're real good old garbage hands like myself. There's a trash heap on the edge of town that we all know's there. We're constantly throwing stuff on top of it. The police don't know about it, but lots of good garbage out there for you, Paula. I bet you'd find what you're looking for at the edge of town. She's like, yeah, she hears about this dump site outside of town. So she gets in the car and she drives over there and she sees it. She's like, her eyes are all bouncing out of her head. Shattered glass, shattered visions of her eyes being slashed out as she falls into this glass. What a weird hobby. I've had some weird hobbies in my life. Collecting can be nice. Right now, you're polishing up your bottles. You're like, oh, finally, an episode I can enjoy. Thanks, Jason. And then I insult your hobby. I don't have anything against bumpy glass. Fine. Like, you can collect whatever you want. I personally draw the limit. My hobbies tend to have the requirement doesn't involve my hands in garbage. I mean, consider me a hoity-toity man of civilization. If I'm part of a hobby or part of a subculture that every so often I have to jump into a dumpster, I think I'm just not going to be part of that subculture. But anyways, my barely veiled disgust over the first part of this story, I'm sure you guys were like, I don't think he really likes this hobby. Sounds gross to me. Sounds gross to me. Like, I mean, I know we talk about a lot of gross stuff on this show. And that stuff's funny. And this is funny, too. But I mean, it's just, I don't know if I could really get into the whole garbage thing. She's a real-life Garbage Pail Kid. She's jumping in. She doesn't jump in. She's like Scrooge McDuck in the money bin. She's like, ah. Her face is all slashed up. She goes down to this dump site, and there's a creek nearby. And she's just like, oh, man, this is like a dream come true. It's garbage. So much garbage. I love it. There's piles of discarded furniture and rusty appliances nearby. Yet at the same time, it's very idyllic. Because this is a place where people are illegally dumping things, and they've been illegally dumping things for years, decades at this point. But it's also like a little grove. There's like trees surrounding the area. The sun is high in the sky. There's a creek trickling by. Kind of nice. I mean, if you're going to spend your day with trash, at least you get a little bit of nice scenery. It's not like she's clambering over mountains of refuse in the city dump. She probably does that too, though. She starts looking around the site, and she's like, come on, bottles, where are you at? I came out here for some bumpy bottles. I hope I find some. But as she's looking around, she starts to notice these holes in the ground. Not like a little, like, sinkhole. She's looking at these things, and they all... There's about six or seven of them. She notices that they look less like a hole and more like a tunnel. Like something had been digging through here. Through the soil, not just through the trash. She's like, oh, it's Bertha, my rival in the bottle business. No, she doesn't think it's another human. She's trying to figure out... what did these? What made these tunnels? And of course, you're probably thinking like chipmunks or hamsters. What are those things that live underground? Groundhogs, prairie dogs. She's kind of looking around. They catch her eye. And she said these holes were all about 2 inches in diameter. So you would think groundhog. That would be my guess, right? Looking for some carrots. An hour and a half later, Paula's still there. She's looking around for some bottles. And she sees movement out of the corner of Ryan. She turns. She's looking. And the movement is actually a little bit of soil being pushed up She sees this clump of soil moving around. Like something's pushing it up from underneath. And she's like, oh, this is going to answer my question. What was making these tunnels? It's not like a burning question. She obviously could have figured it out earlier by sticking her hand inside. She goes, maybe there's a bottle down here. I mean, she didn't spend a ton of time examining these holes. But now that she sees... I'm really afraid of that bee. But now that she sees one of these holes being made, she goes, oh, I'm going to actually see what caused this. And she's watching this chunk of soil move around. It's about 10 feet away from her. And it's about a fist-sized amount of soil being pushed up. Getting pushed up. And Paula's looking at this, and she wants to get closer. She wants to get closer to it, because she's really curious about what this could be. At the same time, she doesn't know if it's dangerous or not. But she does find herself walking a couple feet closer to the soil, when all of a sudden, the soil breaks open, and out pops the creature. Now, it's only 2 inches in diameter, so it can't be super scary. You're not afraid of, like, the boogeyman jumping out. Or maybe it's a 2-inch boogeyman, but she sees this thing push its way out, and it's a... If I was there, because I'm not a big animal person, I would probably just call it a big worm. I would just say I saw a giant worm at the dump. Well, she says she must know more about worms, because she describes it as a worm-like creature popping out of the ground. She said it was 2 inches in diameter. The reason why she doesn't necessarily say it looked like a worm, because the head of the worm was completely round. So, you know, worms normally have, like, those pokey things. That, you know, like, you can't tell if it's the tail or the head. It's kind of pokey. This one was perfectly round. And she's like, oh, that's a worm-like entity. It's not a real worm. And she said the color of it actually matched the soil. It was, like, a light brown color. When she's close enough to this thing, she's still a couple feet away. She's looking at this, and she said it was covered in this peach fuzz. It'd be fun to pet, right? Reach your hand out. A peach fuzz, big worm coming right out of the ground. And you go, okay, she saw a snake or a giant worm. Not even that big of a worm, it's only 2 inches. But, okay, Jason, I guess that's a cryptid. Well, all of a sudden it opens its eyes. And it had 2 big, beautiful, crystal blue eyes. Which are definitely not wormy. Or even snaky. I know snakes have eyes, but aren't they normally like black? Kind of like evil looking eyes. Big, beautiful, crystal blue eyes. That were too big for its head. It almost looked like cartoony. The eyes were too exaggerated. And at this point, I mean, at first you might go, oh, it's a giant worm. But when it opens its eyes, you would be like, well, that's not a worm. Unless you glued googly eyes on it, and they're all like, flipping around and stuff like that. So anyway, so this worm is poking its head out of the dirt. And it looks over at Paula. Looks over almost lazily. And then it just turns away from her. And seems, this was Paula's impression from this thing, it was enjoying the afternoon sunlight. It was just laying there with its head raised up, just feeling the warmth on his wormy skin. And Paula's looking at this thing. She steps closer, and she can't see a nose. She can't see a mouth. She can just see this tube of meat with these big blue eyes. As far as Paula knows, she has no idea how long this thing is, how big it ultimately is. It's just seeing the top of it, and it's just kind of ignoring her, enjoying the sun. Paula claps her hands. She wants the worm to look back at her, but it's not. It doesn't even hear, as far as she can tell. It doesn't have ears. It might not be. Do worms hear? If you yelled at a worm, would it turn and look at you? I don't know if they have ears, but probably not, because you would just hear footsteps all the time. Underground, you're a little warm, you're like, oh, it's time to go eating, and just all day long you hear giants walking 3 inches above you. You're like, ah, the nightmares are true. They probably don't have ears. It's probably super noisy underground with all the vibrations and the ants. So they probably don't have ears. But anyways, as she's clapping and the worm's not looking at her, then she begins waving her arms. Because she knows it has eyes. She's looking at him. She's waving her arms. She's trying to get the worm's attention, but he just won't even look over. He's just looking up at the sun, and he's blinking occasionally, enjoying this warmth on his skin. And Paula said this dude was popping out of the hole for about 5 minutes, just soaking in some vitamin D. And then he just went doop and went back down his hole backwards. Paula went over and she began looking in the hole to see where it went, to see what's going on. But it's too dark to see anything. And being 1999, no one had a cell phone. Cell phones pretty much have flashlights as a standard feature now. She didn't bring her flashlight because she'd be out in the middle of the day in garbage. You don't need a flashlight for that. She's looking down the hole. She doesn't see anything. That next spring, apparently, so next year, she went back out there and she still saw some of the holes were there at the dump site, but she did not see the creature when she returned. I imagine she didn't live in this town. I imagine she was just passing through and was talking to locals about digging through garbage, and they said, why don't you go out to the creek? Because obviously, if this happened in my hometown, if I saw a mysterious worm from beneath our feet, I'd just go back the next day, right? You would just be like, well, I'll just go back the next day, see if that monster's still here. I wouldn't be like, oh, I'll wait till next spring. I think she was just kind of passing through the area. She saw this spring. This was posted on the website paranormal.about.com. It's long gone now. That, you know, the website, I think about.com might even be gone, but it luckily this is all saved in the archives. You can take a look at this again, sustained disgust. Thanks for finding this. It's such a bizarre story. It's one of those stories that you wonder, is it even paranormal? Like, is this a cryptid? Is this like some sort of unknown life form? Or is it a very rarely known life form, or what would be a better way to put that, an obscure life form? People were jumping onto the forum and they were giving ideas of what this thing could be. Some people are like, it was a snake. You saw a snake. And she's like, but snakes don't have big, beautiful blue eyes. One person or a couple of people kind of put it out to be a Caecilian. There's possibly this thing called the Caecilian. It's a worm-like amphibian that can grow up to 5 feet long. Caecilians, they have a Wikipedia page. There's tons of photos of them. They're very obscure. They're one of the least documented amphibians on the fossil record because they're just a big, gross worm. No one, people are walking by its bones. They're all kicking it around. They're like, gross, I don't want to study that one. Give me a T-Rex or something. The paleontologist teacher's like, dude, who kicked all these bones? And you're like, I don't do worms, man. I'm here for the dinosaurs. It's one of the least studied fossil records for an amphibian. They're all over Southern Mexico, Central America, South America, India, places like that. They have these guys. They're super gross. They have a really bad reputation of being poisonous in a lot of these cultures. In Southern Mexico, Central America, the idea is that these worms that do get to be about 5 feet long, not worms, but amphibians, do get to be about 5 feet long. They live in garbage heaps or near the water, and they wait. They wait until you walk by and pull your pants down to go poop in the trash heap, and they climb up your butthole. So I would say, I would definitely say Paula dodged a bullet if she goes, oh, you know what? This hole is already right here, and I really do have to relieve myself. I'm going to poop in the hole, and this thing comes shooting out, climbs up your butthole. Now, they don't actually do that as far as we know. I don't think they've tested it in a laboratory setting. That is a belief, a common belief in Southern Mexico and Central America, if you go to the bathroom in a garbage dump or near a stream, there's a chance one of these things is going to jump out of the soil and climb up your butthole, which would prevent a lot of that, which would prevent a lot of people going to the bathroom outdoors. They're like, I guess I'm going to poop in the corner of the kitchen then. But here's the thing. None of those. The big snake doesn't have big blue eyes. The salian does not have big blue eyes. It also has legs. So maybe she didn't see the legs because it was deeper in the hole, but it definitely didn't have these big blue eyes. So what was this thing? Like, that's the best guess, that it's a salian or cesalian. But even that doesn't match up perfectly. What makes this story even creepier or creepy to begin with? You're like, Jason, that wasn't creepy at all. It's about a big worm. About a big worm. Well, to make the story creepy for the first time, is that a couple of people posted, when she posted this a long time ago, a couple of people posted and said, whatever it was probably a predator. They said, prey is skittish. Anything that is a prey species, when a larger something is nearby clapping and waving hands, or even just in the general vicinity, they're not going to keep their head out for 5 minutes enjoying the sun. If they did, then they wouldn't live long enough to have another generation of such dumb prey. A couple of people said the fact that it had exposed itself for so long in front of you meant that it was most likely a predator. Might have been a predator of buttholes, right? It could have just been wanting to climb up into her pants, slide into her anus. That's possible. Which I would say is predator enough for me. I'd be like, nope, I'm good. Could have wanted to eat her. Could have wanted to devour her. There's a lot of if the Cesalians, there's a lot of beliefs around the world that they're toxic. They're poisonous. You get bit by one, it'll kill you. Because they do have little mouths. So what was this thing? Was it a genetic freak? Was it a one-off occurrence? Is there an unknown species of predators right underneath our feet? We don't know. But the next time you're at the dump, or the next time you need to take a dump, make sure the ground's not moving around you. Keep looking around, you're like, oh, my floor's linoleum. I don't have to worry about this. Whoa, whoa, whoa. There's something big moving under your feet. Be careful, because there might be an unknown species ready to slide up into your anus. It's crazy stuff. Crazy stuff if you think about it. Crazy stuff. I will say this. I will be completely honest with you guys. As much as I thought that story was intriguing the first time I read it. Because I got to read these articles multiple times, obviously. Like, there's a read through and go, oh, is that a good enough story to save? And then I'll go back and I'll read it through more thoroughly two, maybe three times to write my notes up. First time I read it, I was like, golly, big old worm coming up out of the ground. What? And then I committed. I was like, okay, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to spend part of my night typing notes up for the story. And I was typing it up. And I was like, dude, wow, this is crazy. These big monsters right underneath your feet. And then on probably my second read through, I go, what? It's only 2 inches? I didn't, for some reason, I thought it was bigger when I read it the first time. I was like, oh man, the earth is shaking. She's running for her car. The car gets devoured. When I was typing up the notes, I was like, 2 inches, that's it? It's just a 2-inch monster? I mean, that's scary. That would, I mean, if you had your choice between having a gopher run up your pant leg or fighting a 2-inch, you're like, Jason, the worm, clearly. It's not that big. Yeah, it's not that big, but who says size matters? In the world of the worms, it's not how big your head is. It's how quickly you can slide up the butthole. Tori, sorry that you had to be brought on the worm butt episode. Tori, let's go ahead and toss you the keys to the world famous carpenter copter. We're leaving behind small town Oregon. Again, it could be Hood River for all I know. I'm going to be super paranoid about going to poop in public. I'm tossing the keys to the world famous carpenter copter. We're leaving behind Oregon. Fly us all the way out to France. You know, it's funny, we're doing a pirate episode. Actually, a group of the young guys who came to see me at the Oregon Ghost Conference, Liam, Cole, and Eric, they play that boat game. What is it called? Battleship? But they play some pirate game. I forgot what it's called. Sea of Thieves or something like that. They're really into pirate stuff. They are the crew of the Salty Shindig. They have nothing to do with this episode. It's just a little, I probably should have switched up who was hosting which episode had I thought about it. Tori's like, I hate pirates. And that last story was horrifying. I don't like being part of that story either. Sometimes it's funny. There actually a lot of thought goes into who is piloting which episode. Because I'm like, I got an episode coming up about cats that I gotta figure out who's going to be the Patreon supporter or the person who showed up live to pilot us around that episode, because it's pretty barbaric. I could choose not to cover the story, but whoever is driving us around in that episode, they're not going to be happy, because it's a horrible story about cats. But we'll imagine the Salty Shindig, the boat, is floating around in the background as Tori is flying the Carpenter Copter above the mule crew in the Salty Shindig. Keep flying past them. Forget their SOS. They're trying to get our attention because they have run aground. I've passed them up. We're headed all the way out to France. It's the early 1800s. Like 1807, 1808 is when they believe that this boat was first launched. This French ship is put to sea. It's called the Duc de Danzig. And everyone's standing on the boat. They're all clapping. Woo, yeah, we're afloat, ladies and gentlemen. We did it. Unfurl those sails. Sails are coming down, and they're like parrots, like, yeah, squawk, Polly, want a cracker? And everyone's like, yeah, people are like cheering and stuff like that. People are on the piers. They're cheering and all that. Vive la France, they're all saying. This is a boat called the Duc de Danzig. It was a smaller boat, a very common type of boat called a brig. Bunch of people are walking around in the boat. They go, man, this boat's going to be super fast. We got all these guns. We can shoot stuff. It takes about 100 men to crew this vessel. And what do you know? 100 men is just the right amount to also become pirates. It's a good crew of pirates. People are like, what? As they're just launching off of the French docks. Like, did they say they were going to be pirates? I knew there was a parrot there. That should have been my first suspicion. They decide to become privateers. Which is the difference between, I feel, I could be wrong, some history dude may come after me, but there's mercenaries and there's a private army. It's the same thing. It just depends who's paying the bills and who their PR guy is. They're pirates. They're going to work for governments, attacking other ships and looting them and stuff for that. The Duc de Danzig, it was named after the Siege of Danzig that just happened in May of 1807. The guy's like making the boat. He's like, dude, that was a pretty cool siege. Lots of people were starving. A couple moms ate their kids. Let's make a boat about that. Let's name our boat about that. A couple months after it was launched, it's sailing the high seas. It's time to put in work, dude. These pirates, they're ready to go. And they force a ship to ground, which is kind of funny. Like, you could have all, like, let's say you're on a boat, you're ho-ho-hoing, and then you see the Duc de Danzig in the background that's coming towards you. You're like, pirates, there's pirates over there, sir. And the captain's like, left, turn left on this boat. Arm yourselves, men, get your guns and your swords and stuff, and stand on the boat. We're going to get boarded. And you watch this pirate ship coming towards you. And they're like, steady. The boat's getting closer. You're like, steady. Don't shoot them. Don't shoot until you see the parrots on their shoulders. And steady. And you guys are ready to fight hand-to-hand combat against these pirates. And then they just crash into you and put you up on a rock and laugh and then go away. They would ground the ships. That was one of their tactics. It makes sense. That way you don't have to, like, put the knife in your mouth and swing on the rope and land on someone else's boat and take the knife out. There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong with that maneuver. You can land face first, cut your own head off. They made a ship run aground. They love doing stuff like that. They're actually super successful privateers. In 1 month, they took down 4 ships. Now, generally, these guys took mercy on their... This might be the difference between a privateer and a pirate. A lot of times they would loot the ship and they would just leave. They'd leave the boat in running order. and everyone would survive. At least the ones who didn't die in the combat in the taking of the ship. They actually would let them go. Which makes sense, right? Because then it's just like a bully. I think about a bully at school. If he's like, "Hey, you better bring me your lunch money tomorrow, or I'm going to wallop you." And you're like, "Yes, Sam, yeah." And then you go and you get $3 from your mom and you give it to Sam. If you gave him $3 and then he killed you, he's going to have to find a new kid to bully. It would be better to just, like, this crew is waiting outside of the docks, waiting for that ship to get loaded up again. And they're just like waiting. And then the boat takes off. They're like, we're going to rob you guys again. That would be the way to do it. But sometimes, I don't know if they got pissed off or they were just in a kind of a crazy mood, they would burn the boat down. Like, they would take over your vessel, they'd loot it, and then they'd set it on fire. At that point, now you're a pirate. Right now, you're just like a bloodthirsty criminal. You're a mass murderer. You're setting a boat on fire in the middle of nowhere. In the ocean, everybody's going to die. So they were on this quest. At one point, they hit a boat and got 700,000 francs worth of goods. So they're doing quite well for themselves. People knew about this boat. People knew this crew. Governments were hiring them to do things. People were victims of this boat. They had a different captains would come on at certain times. Probably, I mean, like, if you had a boat and the French is like, "We're going to hire you to attack English vessels," you're like, "Totally, that sounds great." I imagine if Portugal hired you, you might want a new captain because they might not like Portuguese people. There were different captains at different times with this boat, but it did develop a reputation. I mean, you don't want to run into this thing. The very best case scenario, you're going to get all your loot taken. Worst case scenario, you're going to get burned alive in the middle of the ocean. 1810, they get a new captain, Francois Argonadou. And he just continues what they're doing, you know, why fix what's not broken? It's like clockwork. You eventually get so good at the job, you could probably do it blindfolded. You could probably do it with one eye closed. And it's been going on for years. People know to avoid the Duke de Zantig. But once it has its sights on you, it's not like you can hide in the middle of the ocean or in the seas, the Caribbean seas, where you're just going back and forth doing all this stuff until it stopped. Nobody knew what happened. But by 1811, around late 1811, people stopped spotting the Duke de Danzig. People didn't see it anymore. Which was a good thing, right? Unless you had a pirate fetish, you're like, "Oh, I hope they raid me tonight." People were very safely getting from point A to point B. I mean, sure, there are other pirates. But these particular pirates who were very successful at their job were no longer to be seen. And people may not have noticed it at first. They probably just considered it good luck that they didn't get raided by this boat. But eventually people start going, "Hey, whatever happened to those pirates that were like stealing all of our stuff?" They're like, "I don't know." I mean, whatever happened to them is our benefit. They're not around anymore. Dangerous life. Not just because every time you want to eat, you have to go into full octane combat with a boat. Every time they wanted to get their job done, they had to physically attack another ship, but also just the environment itself. Apparently, it was sighted one more time after the year 1811. After everyone was finally breathing a sigh of relief that this boat had gotten sunk by somehow, nature, man, who knows. But we don't have to worry about it anymore. It was sighted one more time. An unnamed French frigate sees a ship drifting in the middle of the ocean. Pull alongside that boat, first mate. Might be in trouble, might need some help. "Yes, sir." First mate starts spinning the wheel around. They approach the boat and it's just drifting. It's just drifting there. And as they get closer, they realize that whatever happened here, it was no storm. it was no natural occurrence. It might not have even happened at the hands of other humans. A crew leaves the French frigate and boards this ship that's drifting out in the middle of nowhere, and they immediately begin to notice things that are turning this from a possible rescue mission into a possible escape from a horror novel. When they board the ship, the deck is awash in dried blood. The stench of the decaying bodies is almost too much to bear. Bodies of the crew left out to putrefy, oozing, goozing, pus leaking from their rotting bodies. And if that wasn't bad enough, that's pretty disgusting. Many of them were crucified. They were nailed to the deck of the ship, with their arms outstretched, almost as a mockery of religion, a mockery of Jesus Christ, of the crucifix. Many of the members of this crew were crucified. Some of them to the masts of the boat itself. Some of them to the deck. Some of them, because the crew, they have to figure out what's going on. They're not immediately allowed to jump back off the boat and go back, too spooky. They got to go figure out what happened, see if there's any survivors. They begin to explore the ship. They go into the battery room where all of the cannonades were. There's people crucified against the walls down there. And these crew members, they're checking out this ship. What they notice is a lack of evidence. They said there was no signs of a recent battle. There was no sign of new shot holes. So anytime they'd been hit by a cannonball in the past, obviously you would repair that. They would see the damage of past battles, but there wasn't a fresh hole in the side of the boat here or where it looked like it had been burning recently. There was no signs of a recent battle. The sails were intact, even. So anyone who took this boat by force, they took it without causing any collateral damage. Not even by slicing a sail or piercing it with a bullet on accident. This crew, they do make it to the cabin of the captain, Captain Francois Argandu. And his desk was covered in blood. But there was papers there that they could see. And that's where they saw the captain's name, who the captain of the ship was. And I think that's probably how they knew what boat it was. I don't know if back then they painted the name on the side of the boat. I don't know how you would identify other boats just by looking at them, because it was a very common type of ship that this was. But with the name of the captain, they figured this is the Duke de Danzig. Now, it's possible that it did have the name written on the side as well. But as far as they know, everyone's dead. They could find no survivors on this ship. The crew gets back off of this ghost ship. I mean, literally a ghost ship. And they go back to the captain of the French frigate, and they tell them what they saw. And they say, hey, man, that's pretty bad over there. There's no survivors, blood, the crucifixion, more blood, rotting bodies. And the captain's like, okay, I get it. I'm trying to eat. He's eating clam chowder. He's like, it pushes aside. He's like, yeah, ruin that meal. Captain, do you want us to like tow it in? Do you want us to put a crew over there to pilot it? I mean, what do you want to do? And the captain's like, burn it. And so they did. They set this ship on fire. And they watched as the Duke de Danzig burned feverishly in the middle of the vast ocean. Super interesting story. It's funny because you could go, it's a salty sea legend. Story of a ghost ship. The question is it real? What can we prove and what can we can't? To me, the most interesting, let me say this, very interesting, everyone being crucified, or most of the crew being crucified to this bloody boat as they're rotting in the Son, absolutely fascinating, right? Totally terrifying what happened on that boat. We have no idea. But then I also am thinking, like, how much of it can be true? And once I started finding the initial sources about this story, all seemed to be nonfiction texts, then it really, really had my attention. In the year 1847, there was a book published called French Corsairs Under the Republic and the Empire. Now, this wasn't a book of short stories. It was a history and really a list of all the boats, all of the French corsairs under the French Republic and the French Empire. A listing, not set up to tell flights of fancy. This book came out in 1847, written by Napoleon Galios. He was an author of naval and maritime books. It wouldn't make sense to just make up a story halfway through. We do see we know Captain Francois Arguineau was a real captain at the time. There's a publication called Ship's Register of Maritime Activities, which again was contemporaneous to this timeline. Ship Register of Maritime Activities, in it says Duc de Danzig, unheard of as of 1813, presumed lost with all hands. So we know the boat's real. Sometimes when we come across these stories, I mean, it could all be completely made up. The boat did exist. The captain did exist. The story of the people being crucified and rotting in the sun with an unknown force doing any of it comes out of a nonfiction book. Find it absolutely fascinating. So I think this happened. I think this happened outside of just a Bloody Mary-esque tale to tell to pirates to keep them up at night. So that's what doesn't make sense about it. Why? Imagine if you were reading a book about the history of U.S. tanks in World War II. And then you're reading about this tank and that tank and this tank. And then it gets to the Model 9 Charlie tank. And it says the Model 9 Charlie tank was a prototype that was made in Detroit working with new methods. Unfortunately, a man fell into the boiling hot steel made for the cannon. The tank became self-aware and broke its way out of the factory. Authorities are still looking for that tank to this day. And the next entry goes, Dallas Model 9, a tank that was used during the early days of the African. You'd be like, wait, what? Wait, what? What's this entry here? Is this real? In this nonfiction book about the history of tanks, is it really telling me that one of them is alive? Wait, what? And everything before that part and everything after that part is totally legit. Now, you could say, well, maybe Napoleon heard that story and thought it sounded cool and wanted to include it in his book. Again, I would argue anyone can do anything. I would argue the people who were reading that book would go like, hey, what's up with this part? Everything else seems legit. There is a book called Ship's Register of Maritime Activities, and in that it says, quote, Duc de Danzig, unheard of as of 1813, presumed lost with all hands. So we have that book as well. And there are other books that are sourced in the Wikipedia page that talk about all of this stuff. So, very, very interesting story. The question is, I mean, obviously you can say, well, that still doesn't prove that it happened. And that's fine, right? Everyone can say anything they want. But I mean, I'm not the arbiter of truth. But what happened? We've discussed, did it happen? What happened? What could this have been? I mean, it really just is so evocative of every possible thing that could go wrong. This is basically the old-timey naval equivalent of Event Horizon, where hell opened up on this boat. You could say it was maritime raiders. It was a rival government or another boat that was looking for revenge, or even another group of pirates that overtook the ship and just brutally slaughtered everyone, crucified the people. Not all of them, but many of them are crucified to different parts of the ship. Yeah, that's probably the most likely answer. But again, the interesting thing is the crew that was aboard, the crew that left the French frigate and boarded the Duc de Danzig, they did not notice any signs of a recent battle. And these were guys who sailed enough to know what the signs of a recent battle were. I wouldn't. I mean, unless it was like currently on fire and someone's shooting at me, I couldn't say, no, nothing's going on here. Or, yeah, it's a sign of a recent battle. Any wounds that the ship had would have amassed during a battle would have been visible. And if they were older damage to the ship, they would have been repaired. There's no reason even the sails weren't shredded or even cut. So it does kind of make you think of a supernatural answer for this. We know it's not natural. We know a typhoon didn't do this. It could have been ship madness, right? You could have had some crazy mutiny happen. But again, where are the signs of the battle? Because so many people are crucified, it really does make you think diabolical. Not just supernatural, not alien abduction, but demonic. The mockery of God's sacrifice as Jesus, right? It's taking that same thing and crucifying these brigands to this ship. Very, very evocative of darkness. But a true mystery. A true mystery. Now, to the people who sailed the seas at that time, of course, this wasn't the only group of pirates. It was just something they had to deal with. But one less pirate ship out there, one less group of privateers hunting your cargo down, the better. I'm sure a lot of people were glad when they finally realized that the Duc de Danzig hadn't been seen in a while. But I think even the saltiest sea dog said a little prayer for the crew of that ship after they heard the story of what was found floating on the high seas. An entire crew wiped out and left to rot. Dead flesh crucified to the deck as seagulls filled their belly full of tender innards. A blood-drenched ship floating alone, lost in the waves. Nobody deserves that type of ending. And even when the ship was set on fire and burned until it could burn no more, until all that was left of the Duc de Danzig sank into the watery depths below, even the most battle-hardened sailor of the time, even the most experienced captains, all of them knew one thing. True evil isn't destroyed that easily. And whatever happened to the crew of the Duc de Danzig could someday also happen to them. DeadRabbitRadio@gmail.com is going to be our email address. You can also hit us up at facebook.com/DeadRabbitRadio. TikTok is @DeadRabbitRadio. Dead Rabbit Radio is the daily paranormal conspiracy and true crime podcast. You don't have to listen to it every day, but I'm glad you listened to it today. Have a great day, guys.